The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Hello, people. My name is Hadding Scott, not Carolyn Yeager here. Welcome to The Heretics Hour for the 1st of April, 2013. Tonight, I'm going to talk about some questions about what Hitler wanted to do in foreign policy and the question of war guilt and was he really trying to conquer the world? I think this is a very important question. Actually, it's neglected. A lot of people don't really think about it very much, but it ties in with the Holocaust question that people talk about so much, because how can you kill all the Jews if you don't have all the Jews under your control? You pretty much have to conquer the world if you're going to kill all the Jews. If you can't show that Hitler was going to conquer the world, then, you know, that kind of lets the air out of that. In particular, I'm going to make reference to Hitler's secret book, so-called, which is not really a secret book. It was apparently supposed to be a third book of Mein Kampf. There were two books of Mein Kampf that were published in 1925 and 1926. Book two talks about foreign policy a little bit. Book three is all about foreign policy. It's about 145 pages in German, and there's a PDF on archive.org in English that's about 111 pages. It's not a finished book. It's obviously not finished. It has some repetitions in it that should be cut out. Some things not expressed completely. It was not a finished book. And I don't think I don't think it's really a secret book either, in the sense that he was hiding things. Well, at least not very much, because I've seen some of the ideas in it in news reports about Hitler from the 1930s and 20s also. The book was only published after the war, but the authenticity of it is supposedly confirmed by people who should have known. So here we go. After the First World War, we have to start with the First World War a little bit, because the whole propaganda about the Second World War is really rooted in the First World War. After the First World War, there was a great disillusionment about why that war had been fought. The idea that the United States had fought a war to make the world safe for democracy, which is what Wilson had said, was widely regarded as a bad joke after 1920. And the Treaty of Versailles, which arbitrarily assigned war guilt to Germany and none to the victorious powers, France, England, so forth, was also widely regarded as unjust. For this reason, the treaty was never ratified. And I bet you didn't know this. Treaty of Versailles was never ratified by the French Parliament. Only Britain and Japan ratified the Treaty of Versailles, and Germany itself, which was, well, they had a social democrat government who were called November criminals by the National Socialists. They were not considered patriotic by the National Socialists anyway. On top of the fact that the treaty was in itself unjust, the victorious powers themselves did not even abide by its terms. In particular, they did not abide by the stipulation that they too must disarm. This is a fact about the Treaty of Versailles that seems to have almost completely fallen down the memory hole. You really have to read particular books to find out that Britain and France were supposed to disarm under the Treaty of Versailles. I actually had a university history professor argue with me about it. I had read it in a book called Unconditional Hatred. I I believe that's the title of it, Unconditional Hatred, by a British Navy captain. Captain is a very high rank in the Navy. And he said that the Allies were supposed to disarm, and they never did. And I said to this professor of history, I said, you know, the Allies were supposed to disarm, and they never did. He said, what? No, I never heard that. This guy managed to get a PhD in history and teach at a university and didn't know that. So, did Hitler violate the Treaty of Versailles by rearming Germany? Regarding events in the 6 years prior to World War II, the usual interpretation that we are presented is that the passive and ambivalent allies, who should have been enforcing the Treaty of Versailles and keeping the dangerous German war machine from rising again, instead allowed a treacherous thug named Adolf Hitler to get away with one transgression after another until he was so emboldened as to undertake a war to conquer the entire world. This historical interpretation, by the way, has been used over and over since then to goad U.S. citizens into supporting wars since World War II on the premise that somebody else is now the new Hitler, and that it is imperative not to make the old mistake of attempting to deal with this new Hitler peacefully. Because, you know, where there's a new Hitler, you have to watch out and be careful not to be the new Neville Chamberlain, which is kind of like not having any manhood, right? You have to prove your manhood. You have to prove that you're not another Neville Chamberlain. I remember some articles like that. I think George Will wrote something like that around the time of the invasion of Iraq, circa 2003-2002. What has been dropped down the memory hole is that the Allies, as well as Germany, had been supposed to reduce their armed forces according to the Treaty of Versailles, but they never did. Hitler's decision to reintroduce German military conscription and an air force and to have an army exceeding 100,000 men followed a decision by France to increase the size of her own army. France had just increased its own army. So Hitler said, well, I'm going to increase my army too. Hitler's characterization of the Treaty of Versailles as unjust, imposed as it was on an unwilling but helpless Germany, is often treated with ridicule. Be that as it may, is it not the case that a treaty, having been ignored with impunity by one side, may legitimately be considered null and void by the other? It seems reasonable to argue that from the point of view of justice, at the time that Hitler announced the rearmament of Germany in 1935, the so-called treaty had already been effectively rendered a dead letter. Hear what a former British Prime Minister and a former U.S. Secretary of State had to say about it. This is from an article that circulated in the United Press, which is now United Press International. On the 18th of March, 1935, the article is titled, Lloyd George Blames Allies. Lloyd George was the British Prime Minister during World War I. Lloyd George blames Allies. David Lloyd George, Britain's wartime Prime Minister, said tonight the former Allied powers were to blame for forcing Germany to rearm. Quote, let us keep our heads, the shaggy-maned old statesman said. The signatories to Germany's Treaty of Versailles are in no position morally to enforce those parts of the treaty which they themselves have so flagrantly and defiantly broken. The British government, after the issue of its recent white paper, has no right to complain at Germany's gesture coming before the proposed Berlin conversations. We are now face to face with reality. We should regard recent developments, including the white paper and France's decision to increase her army, and finally Hitler's declaration, as finally giving us a providential opportunity to clear up the whole mess. means the mess of the vindictive Treaty of Versailles. And then that U.S. Secretary of State, former U.S. Secretary of State, Frank B. Kellogg, whose name was on the Kellogg-Briand Pact. From the Associated Press, the 21st of March, 1935. I don't believe the nations of Europe are entirely free from blame in this situation. In the Versailles Treaty, they pledged themselves to disarm. If any of them have done so, I do not recall which and when. Of course, that is no excuse for Germany to violate her treaty agreements, but there is some truth in Hitler's statements, if I read them correctly, that the other nations have agreed to reduce armaments, and none of them has done so. So you see there, it was a well-known fact in 1935 that the Allies had been supposed to disarm, and they didn't do it. So why do you still hear people talking about how outrageous it was that Adolf Hitler violated the Treaty of Versailles? That was one criticism of the treaty and of First World War propaganda. On the 26th of January, 1929, the United Press ran a substantial article quoting the former Kaiser, Wilhelm II, to the effect that he had always striven for peace. Kaiser Wilhelm said that he always tried to maintain peace. And he blamed France and Russia for the First World War. Now, you may not think it's very weighty that the Kaiser says that he was not responsible for the war, but the United Press ran a very large article featuring his statements, and they also featured comments on his statements. It featured comments from Professor Harry Elmer Barnes of Smith College in Massachusetts, who was very prominent. He was the editor of the Council on Foreign Relations Foreign Affairs magazine, which, by the way, is one of the reasons why I don't see the CFR as the seat of all evil that some people may make it to be. Harry Elmer Barnes agreed with what the Kaiser had said. This is what it says in the article. Quote, "The overwhelming responsibility for the world war rests upon France and Russia," close quote. Dr. Harry Elmer Barnes, noted historian and sociologist, declared today in discussing the United Press statement in which the former Kaiser disclaims blame for starting the conflict. Quote, "The Kaiser has spoken the truth," close quote, declared former Senator Robert L. Owen of Oklahoma in an interview with the United Press today. There are also some negative opinions expressed in that article, predictably by the former French Premier Clemenceau, who was a great warmonger, and by former U.S. State Department official, who probably had his own tracks to cover, plus a couple of neutral opinions. All in all, given how thoroughly the Kaiser had been demonized a decade before 1929, this represented a remarkable shift in how that man and how Germany in the First World War was perceived. Around that same time, British Parliament admitted that much of the anti-German propaganda of the First World War, like tossing babies onto bayonets, had been lies. Yes, they accused the Germans during the First World War of tossing babies onto bayonets, cutting hands off of Belgian children, crucifying Canadian soldiers. The starting point for Anglo-American propaganda of the Second World War was to pretend that none of this revision had taken place. The very fact that governments lie outrageously during wartime, which everybody should have observed, was also forgotten Even the specific lie of bayoneting babies was recycled in the Second World War, although in the Second World War it was applied to the Japanese rather than the Germans. Now, I haven't specifically investigated the claim against the Japanese, but when you hear the history of this accusation, you'll see a pattern, I think. This accusation of tossing babies around on bayonets has quite a history. I found in the Hartford Weekly Times of the 3rd of May, 1883, British soldiers in Ireland were accused of tossing Irish babies onto bayonets. Yeah, British soldiers were accused of tossing babies onto bayonets. In 1900, Russian Cossacks were accused of tossing Chinese babies onto bayonets. This would make Germans and Japanese, of course, latecomers in that form of sport, bayonet baby tossing. So I think it's reasonable to be skeptical about the story just on its face whenever it comes up, because it's an old standard of war propaganda, tossing babies on bayonets. According to the renewed propaganda of the Second World War, the Germans, from Bismarck to Kaiser Wilhelm II to Hitler, were simply incurable, congenital world conquerors. The Germans had a congenital disorder that made them want to conquer the world. And therefore, you just couldn't trust the Germans. They're going to try to conquer the world at the first chance they get. All right, that's your World War II, World War I propaganda. One of the most influential pieces of World War II propaganda is the U.S. Army's series of films. They run about an hour. Some of them are an hour and a half. Some of them are a little shorter than an hour, probably. Called Why We Fight. Very well-produced film. Directed by Frank Capra. Frank Capra, the famous director. Famous director who directed films that you may have seen. I believe he did It's a Wonderful Life and Arsenic and Old Lace, which are great films. They had Jews also writing scripts for these things. Some of them weren't born in the United States even. The second episode of the U.S. Army's Why We Fight series begins with this. This is called The Nazi Strike, if I recall correctly. It says this on the screen in text. It says, German ambitions for world conquest go back a long way. 1863, Otto von Bismarck says, we will dominate the whole world. 1914, Kaiser Wilhelm II says, God has made us for civilizing the world. Woe and death to all who resist my will. 1933, Adolf Hitler says, my motto is destroy by all and any means. National Socialism will reshape the world. So you see, you have this practically a dynasty of crazy German leaders that want to conquer the world, according to Why We Fight, this U.S. Army film, which you've probably seen on television at some time or other. Now, I have looked into the veracity or the authenticity of various statements that are claimed in the Why We Fight series of propaganda films. I have found that most of the statements attributed to Adolf Hitler in Why We Fight can be shown not to be authentic. That last statement of those three attributed to Hitler is definitely bogus. It's a shortened version of a statement that appears in The Voice of Destruction, also called Conversations with Hitler, which was written by a disgruntled former member of the National Socialist German Workers' Party named Hermann Rauschning. Rauschning was a prolific source of misinformation about Adolf Hitler's mind and his intentions. But he was very influential in Western war propaganda, in U.S. war propaganda especially. During the Second World War, Rauschning even became a U.S. citizen, and he testified at the mass sedition trial of 1944 about the character of Adolf Hitler, and he was cross-examined for 10 hours by Lawrence Dennis. But he even had a weekly newspaper column that was read all over the country. This traitor, this liar, well, I didn't tell you that, but it's found out that all of Rauschning's alleged conversations with Hitler are fiction. There was a Swiss researcher named Wolfgang Heinel, H-A-E-N-E-L, in the 1980s, who discovered that Rauschning's dialogues with Hitler, where Rauschning claimed that he'd actually had conversations with Hitler and Hitler said this and that, that these conversations were fictional. In some cases, Hitler was not in the alleged location at the time of the alleged conversation, therefore he could not have been involved. And you have the principle falsum in uno, falsum in omnibus, false in one thing, false in all things. When you find out that one part of something is definitely not true, it casts the whole bunch of it in doubt, all right? Some of the things that Rauschning has Hitler say are traceable to Friedrich Nietzsche and probably some other sources, but I recognize some of it as Nietzsche. Rauschning himself was one of these, he was a revolutionary conservative, one of those losers, the people that never could get a following. And he was apparently resentful against Hitler for some reason. So he made up all these defamatory conversations and made Hitler look like a madman out to take over the world. So yes, if you can show that a statement came from Rauschning, you've proven that it's not genuine. And the third statement of those three in Why We Fight attributed to Hitler is from Rauschning, therefore we know it's fake. Now, the statement attributed to the Kaiser, I had to track down the source of that because there's no source given in Why We Fight. Most of the time they don't give a source, probably for good reason. But I tracked it down. There was a newspaper in New Zealand that claimed that this was from a proclamation that the Kaiser made to his army on the 13th of September, 1914. The full alleged quote is this: "The Spirit of God has descended upon me because I am the German Emperor. I am the instrument of the Most High. I am his sword, his representative on earth. Woe and death to those who oppose my will. Death to the infidel who denies my mission. Let all the enemies of the German nation perish. God demands their destruction. God, who by my mouth summons you to carry out his decrees." That's in the Poverty Bay Herald from New Zealand, 6th of October, 1917. Well, since I got a date associated with that alleged quote, by the way, isn't that just crazy on itself? You'd have to be a madman to talk like that. Already on its face, you should be suspicious of that. You should say, how can somebody in that kind of position be that crazy? Well, I did a little searching on Google News Archive. I found that the words woe and death, which begin that speech, that little utterance, those words do not appear associated with the Kaiser's name in newspapers until the 4th of August, 1918, which is 4 years after the words were allegedly uttered. 4 years with no reporting on that, and then in 1918, they claim that he said this. That's a pretty good indication that the Kaiser didn't actually say it. news media were pretty good about reporting anything the Kaiser said that sounded a little crazy. For example, in 1908, he said, "You English are mad, mad, mad as March hares." That made worldwide news. But this thing about his being God's representative on Earth somehow didn't make it into the news. Oh, baloney. When that alleged quote appeared in 1918, it was in a book called The Black Book, A History of the Hun. A History of the Hun. They're calling Germans Huns. By Tressler Long and Franklin Hobbes. This is blatant anti-German war propaganda. Hate propaganda, you could even say. So we can say that that's extremely unlikely to be a real quote. If I wanted to prove it absolutely, I'd have to find out exactly what the Kaiser was doing on the 13th of September, 1914. But I already have pretty strong evidence that he probably didn't make that statement. As for Bismarck's statement, we will dominate the whole world, which he's supposed to have said in 1863, which is fairly early in his political career, I couldn't find any evidence for that statement connected to Bismarck's name. I mean, anything like a contemporary reference to it, or even from the First World War. I think they may have even made that one up in 1943 when this series of films was made. It's a possibility. But it's a pretty vague statement anyway. What does dominate mean? Doesn't mean take over the world militarily, necessarily. Well, I found it convenient for comparing Hitler's actual views on foreign policy and world conquest to consult a book by Hitler that was specifically about his foreign policy ideas. And that is the projected but never published during Hitler's lifetime third book of Mein Kampf, which is sometimes called the secret book, Hitler's secret book. The main focus of Hitler's unpublished third book is foreign policy. Although in the second volume of Mein Kampf from 1925, Hitler had written that Germany could ally with either England or Russia. In the secret book from 1928, he says that Russia is out of the question as an ally for Germany, and that Germany must ally with England and Italy. Well, he should ally with England and Italy. That's the alliance policy that he favored as of 1928. And I found a reference in a newspaper from, I believe, 1930. There was an article comparing Hitler and Mussolini before Hitler even came to power, that said that he wanted an alliance with England and Italy. So that part of the secret book at least wasn't secret. A lot of these things, these ideas apparently made their way into his speeches. Now, of course, as we know, in retrospect, Hitler ended up changing his mind about making an alliance with Russia when England's friendship turned out to be impossible to get. Although he didn't really make an alliance, he made a non-aggression pact. But he suggested at times that it could become more than just a non-aggression pact. As a matter of fact, as late as August 1939, in his last meetings with the British ambassador, who was Neville Henderson, before the outbreak of war, Hitler was still asking for an alliance with England. He was still asking for an alliance with England in 1939. August 1939. This was reported in newspapers at the time. Hitler makes a convincing argument in his so-called secret book that it was in England's rational national interest to ally with Germany. England had this interest because Russia was a threat to India, which was a British colonial possession at the time, and because the United States posed a very great threat to Britain's interests. yes, the United States was a threat to British interests. You can find this observation about the conflict between American and British interests already in the 19th century. The great German-American economist, Friedrich List, he immigrated to the United States from Germany and became very influential in the United States. Friedrich List wrote about how England's ability to export manufactured goods to the rest of the world had been damaged by the growth of both the United States and Germany as economic industrial powers. So, Hitler also opines that it is in the interests of the world to be under English rather than American subjugation. Bear in mind that at the time, the British Empire encompassed a very large portion of the world's land mass. Canada, Australia, India, and a very large part of Africa was subject to England. Hitler states that if this English dominance were destroyed, it would be replaced by an American dominance in the world. Isn't that what has happened? The United States today, under Jewish manipulation, maintains by far the largest military in the world and by far the most expensive. Those are the two alternatives in Hitler's mind: an English-dominated world or an American-dominated world. Hitler would like to maintain the English-dominated world by allying with England. He thinks that Germany can get along with England just by not getting in England's way by becoming a naval power and relying on global exports. The possibility of a German-dominated world is never mentioned. It's never mentioned anything about Germany dominating the world in the secret book, at least not that I could find. Maybe I missed it. But here's a passage from the so-called secret book where Hitler talks about this matter. This is Adolf Hitler speaking. If Germany would succeed in taking part in a new state coalition in Europe, which either must lead to a shift of emphasis in the League of Nations itself, or allow decisive power factors altogether outside the League of Nations to develop, then the first domestic political prerequisite for a later active foreign policy would be realizable. The weaponlessness imposed on us by the Versailles Treaty, and thus our practical defenselessness, could come to an end, albeit slowly. This is possible only if the coalition of victors itself quarrels over this question, but never, however, in an alliance with Russia, let alone in a union with other so-called oppressed nations against the front of the coalition of the former victor states that encircle us. Then, in the far future, it may be possible to think of a new association of nations consisting of individual states with a high national value, which could then stand up to the threatening overwhelming of the world by the American Union. For it seems to me that the existence of English world rule inflicts less hardships on present-day nations than the emergence of an American world rule. Pan-Europe cannot be summoned to the solution of this problem, but only a Europe with free and independent national states, whose areas of interest are divergent and precisely delimited. Only then can the time ripen for Germany, secured by a France pushed back within her own boundaries and supported by her army born, this means Germany, supported by her army born anew, to lead the way toward the elimination of Germany's territorial need. Once our folk, however, will have grasped this great geopolitical aim in the East, the consequence will not only be clarity regarding German foreign policy, but also stability, at least for a humanly predictable time, will make it possible to avoid political insanities, like those which ultimately tangled our folk in the World War. And then we will also have ultimately overcome the period of this petty daily clamor and of the completely sterile economic and border policy. Okay, I wonder if you caught the implications of what he said there. He says that Germany should take part in a new state coalition. That means there's still going to be states. There's still going to be countries other than Germany. That's the first paragraph there. Then he says in the second paragraph, then in the far future, it may be possible to think of a new association of nations. So he's saying that even in the far future, Germany will not have conquered the whole world. You're still going to have independent states in the far future. And he also says that the existence of English world rule, which means the British Empire basically, inflicts less hardships on present day nations than the emergence of an American world rule. There's nothing here about Germany conquering the world. It's completely incompatible with that idea. Completely. Hitler was correct, of course, in anticipating that the English-dominated world would give way to an American-dominated world. Symbolically, this is reflected in the fact that the former British colonies, Canada, Australia, and others, adopted a dollar rather than a pound as their currencies. In concrete terms, Britain has become, in effect, the United States' lapdog, being dragged along into Middle East wars demanded by the Zionists in Washington, D.C. Hitler mentions the possibility that England might not pursue her rational national interest. He says that it's possible that England could be diverted in the wrong direction somehow through Jewish influence. But he doesn't linger on that possibility, even though that's what eventually happened. And we can view this on Hitler's part as either the triumph of wishful thinking or perhaps the fact that there was no good alternative to hoping that the English would act in a sensible manner and not be mad, mad, mad as March hares, the way the Kaiser said. Evidently, Hitler did not understand that because of the British war debt, Britain was subject to financial pressure from the United States. According to Congressman Hamilton Fish, the Roosevelt administration used financial pressure to push Britain into war. Fish discusses this in a book called FDR, The Other Side of the Coin. Congressman Fish says, in effect, that the Roosevelt administration pressured Neville Chamberlain to go to war. And as evidence for that, he quotes from the Forrest Dahl Diaries, where Neville Chamberlain says that the United States and the world Jews forced Britain into war. Chamberlain supposedly said that to Joe Kennedy. Joe Kennedy played golf with Admiral Forrest Dahl, and Forrest Dahl wrote it in his diary. Very famous quote. Now, for all that to be credible, that Neville Chamberlain allowed himself to be pushed into war, that Britain was pushed into war through financial pressure, you have to ask, how could you pressure a country to go to war when it's going to be disastrous? And it was disastrous for Britain. They lost their empire. They went deeper into debt. They lost a lot of men, of course. The answer is that Chamberlain didn't really think it was going to be as disastrous as it was. Even after declaring war in 1939, Chamberlain didn't expect to have to wage a real war. After the German invasion of Poland, there was what was called the Phony War, also called the Sitzkrieg. from September 1939 until Germany finally invaded France in May 1940. During that time, during the phony war, France and Britain were not exactly doing nothing. The strategy was to wage an economic war by not allowing goods to go in and out of Germany. It was thought that they could starve Germany, that they wouldn't have to actually make a military attack. The British and the French thought that they could simply sit behind the Maginot Line and wait for Germany to attack, was expressed by Marshal Pétain when he said that whoever made the first move in the war, whoever attacked, would lose. Because you see, the Germans had built their own fortifications in the Rhineland. So there were strong defensive preparations on both sides. Nobody really wanted to attack the other side. At least not at the fortifications. That was the British and French strategy in early 1940. They were going to try to starve Germany, and they thought that if Hitler tried to do anything about it, Germany would take a beating for it. Of course, that turned out to be very wrong, because although the French army looked much stronger on paper, the German army was using a new strategy called Blitzkrieg, you probably heard of that, which made the very numerous but slow-moving French tanks designed for infantry support, the tactics of the First World War, completely obsolete. There was no excuse for not attempting to make the changes that Hitler recommended in German foreign and domestic policy, he said, because Germany, as it was heading for ruin. In other words, even, this is how I interpret that, one interpretation of it, that even if it might not be possible to get England's friendship and an alliance with England, it was still worth pursuing. Hitler states that German policy prior to the First World War and during the 1920s had no clear and sensible priorities. Above all, he faults that foreign policy for not being based on the welfare of the German people. There was no war aim that Germany had in the First World War that would benefit the German people. This is where Hitler's populism comes in. They went through all that bloodletting in the First World War, the ordinary working-class German people, without even a goal in view that would help them. For Hitler, this was wrong. This was criminal, according to Hitler, given the enormous sacrifice in blood that the German people had been required to make. There should be a war aim that serves the welfare of the people. Hitler states that the overall purpose of foreign policy must be to secure the future survival of the nation. The purpose of foreign policy, the highest purpose of foreign policy, must be to secure the survival of the nation. Is this how U.S. foreign policy is formulated? Are all of these Middle East wars related in any way to the survival of an American people? We are sold the idea that it has something to do with that. They hate our freedom. Maybe the Taliban will come over here and force our women to wear burqas. Who knows? But people with their head on their shoulders don't believe stuff like that, I don't think. Are these expensive wars being waged for Israel for some purpose that has nothing to do with the well-being of the American people, like the security of the state of Israel? Anybody who has really been paying attention knows that this is the case. According to Adolf Hitler, foreign policy must serve the interests of the nation. The nation that fights the war. According to Hitler, guaranteeing the survival of the nation involves subordinate goals. The first one is securing sustenance for the population, preferably through self-sufficiency in agricultural production, although there are other ways to secure a nation's survival that are less reliable, such as foreign trade. But Hitler wants Germany to become self-sufficient on the European continent with farmland, sufficient farmland to feed herself and not have to get in Britain's way on the high seas as a competing colonial and naval power. That's his preference. Although he ended up changing his mind about that in terms of what he ended up doing, what he ended up seeking during the 1930s. Another subordinate purpose of securing the nation's survival is geopolitics. In other words, establishing defensible borders for Germany. Hitler complains in the secret book in great detail about how the borders established for Germany after the First World War were not defensible. And I would say, since the Sudeten Mountains of Czechoslovakia, which were inhabited mostly by Germans, were given to Czechoslovakia, creating the problem of a large German minority in Czechoslovakia. Did you know that there were almost as many Germans as Slovaks in Czechoslovakia? Oh, yeah. It was a big problem. Since this was arranged that way, it appears to me as if Germany's borders were deliberately designed to be indefensible. The victorious powers of the First World War did not want Germany to be able to defend herself at all. In addition to limiting Germany's military to a very small force, they also established borders for Germany that were impossible to defend. There are no natural barriers between Czechoslovakia and Berlin. There are no significant natural barriers between the Polish border of 1939 and Berlin, nor even given today's Polish border. And the eastern border of Germany, established after the First World War, is so long that it requires a huge number of troops to defend it. It's really an impossible geopolitical situation that the victors created for Germany at Versailles. This is a reason, I believe, why Hitler actually was impelled to try to rectify that situation. He had to get the Sudeten Mountains into Germany. That's why at Munich he got Prime Minister Chamberlain to agree that Germany should possess the Sudeten Mountains. Not entirely just to have the Germans live there in Germany, although that was a good thing and it was consistent with Hitler's general goals. But it was especially important because of the Sudeten Mountains. Because with the Sudeten Mountains on the other side of the border in Czechoslovakia, Czechoslovakia was practically a highway into the heart of Germany from the east. On top of that, Czechoslovakia was allied with France. So it was a dangerous situation. And Hitler wanted to remedy that. Then you had the problem of the long, long border with Poland. Now, in 1934, the leader of Poland was a man named Pilsudski. Hitler actually expressed admiration for Pilsudski. He liked Pilsudski. Hitler made a non-aggression pact with Pilsudski's government of Poland in 1934. This was a good arrangement for Germany because if Poland was friendly to Germany, then the very long border with Poland was no longer as much a concern as if Poland were hostile. See, what happened later on is that Pilsudski's friendly government was replaced by a hostile government, which was very alarming, of course, from a geopolitical perspective, because Germany was extremely vulnerable to attack. Not only necessarily from Polish troops, but from Red Army troops that might come in through Poland. So that's why Hitler ended up seeking a territorial adjustment. Well, first he canceled the non-aggression pact with Poland in 1939, and then he sought a territorial adjustment to get rid of that hostile Polish government and establish a more secure border. Hitler says that ideally Germany should have her Lebensraum on the European continent, not some Lebensraum in the form of African colonies. Having the Lebensraum, the agricultural land in Europe, where Germans could grow food for Germany, would eliminate the need for Germany to rely on the United Kingdom, on the goodwill of the United Kingdom, to get her food from her food producers to her food market. And it also eliminates the need to compete with Britain as a naval power. The idea of getting along with the United Kingdom plays a huge role in Hitler's foreign policy thinking. Now, Hitler had written the same in the second book of Mein Kampf, and this is actually a good example of how Hitler was prone to change his mind. Because instead of what he wrote in the second book of Mein Kampf and in this never-published third book, during the 1930s, Hitler started talking about colonies again, about African colonies, which had been taken away from Germany at the Conference of Versailles and given to Great Britain. Germany wanted back Southwest Africa and other colonies so that they would have a place to grow food. Hitler has deviated from his ideal course and started pursuing a less ideal course because that was convenient. You know, in his books, he outlines what he would ideally do if all the circumstances were perfect. But when the rubber hits the road, when he has to think about really doing it, in a lot of cases, Hitler's bark turns out to be worse than his bite. This is also true if you look at some of his speeches about the war, after the war started. He said, well, this is according to Tolan's biography of Hitler, Hitler made a fire-breathing speech in the Sportpalast about how he was going to level London. And then the next thing he did was tell the Luftwaffe to be careful, try not to hit civilian targets. Try not to hit targets that aren't of military interest. So he changed his mind quite a bit. You can't really take something that Hitler wrote in the 1920s and say that what he's doing in 1940, 1942 is necessarily what he wrote. In that last meeting with Neville Henderson just before the start of the war in 1939, he was saying that he would like to have the colonies back. Of course, it didn't happen. Now, on how to deal with ethnic minorities, Hitler rejects the idea of Germanizing any non-German populations. See, Mussolini had this policy of Italianizing non-Italian populations. They had various ethnic minorities, and Mussolini's policy was that they all must learn Italian. Hitler didn't want to do that with the Slavs and so forth, according to what he says in this third book of Mein Kampf. But later, in the Tischgespräche, the table talk, he actually does talk about doing exactly that. If I recall correctly, he says that about half the Slav, half the Poles were racially suitable for Germanization. And the Croats someday could be Germanized. And he wants to Germanize the Norwegians also. And, well, according to table talk, he wants to make Norway part of Germany. So that's another respect in which Hitler somewhat changed his mind. Hitler suggests that he might remove a racially inferior population that might inhabit some territory conquered by Germany. That's the word in the English translation, remove. In case you might have some misgivings about what that word means, the word that Hitler uses in German is entfernen. Entfernen literally means to move something far away, to put something far away. Fern means far in German. Entfernen means to put it far away. He's not talking about killing anyone. He's talking about sending the racially undesirable people to live somewhere else, which was not unprecedented during the French and Indian War back in the 1700s. England removed French Acadians from the maritime provinces of Canada. We call those people Cajuns today. They resettled in Louisiana. The United States had done the Cherokee removal about 90 years before Hitler's writing. And as recently as 1923, Turkey and Greece had both expelled their Christian and Muslim populations, respectively. During the Second World War, more than 1.5 million people, including Volga Germans, were relocated from one part of the Soviet Union to another. After the Second World War, as many of you probably know, Germans living in Czechoslovakia, Poland, and Yugoslavia were forced in a very brutal way to leave places where they lived for many centuries. And simultaneously, Poles were forced to leave what had been Eastern Poland and became part of the USSR. So you see, a lot of countries were doing this expulsion of ethnic minorities or undesired population. It was not unique to Hitler at all.
Im Westen und Osten, sie liegen in aller Welt, und ihre Helme verrosten, und Kreuz und Hügel zerfällt. Sie liegen verscharrt und versunken im Massengrab und im Meer, aber es leben Halunken, und die ziehen noch über sie her. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Sie waren nicht ausgezogen um Beute und schnöden Gewinn. Was heute verlacht und verlogen, es hatte für sie einen Sinn. Sie hatten ihr junges Leben nicht weniger lieb als die, heute Höhnen es hinzugeben, sei reine Idiotie. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon stark. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon stark. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. demonstrieren, mehr Freizeit bei höherem Lohn. Sie mussten ins Feld marschieren, der Vater, der Bruder, der Sohn. Sie gingen die Heimat zu schützen und haben allen entsagt. Was kann uns der Einsatz nützen, hat keiner von ihnen gefragt. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit und welche Erbärmlichkeit.
All right. I'm going to look at something else in the second hour. I would have liked to have gone into much greater detail about Hitler's secret book, as it's called, and also more debunking of the propaganda. If you want to know a little more about it, you can go to my blog, which is national-socialist-worldview.blogspot.com. Okay? I'm going to talk about something else in this second hour, since I didn't get as much material organized as I would have liked. That subject that I was discussing in the first hour requires digesting and organizing a lot of material, and I just didn't get as much done as I would have liked. So I'm going to look at a book here. This is a book called it's called The Truth About Lynching and the Negro. And it's by a professor of history from Claremont College named Winfield Collins. He was a professor of English and history. And the book was published in 1918. A lot of interesting books about Negroes were published before the 1930s. Back then, it was okay to tell the truth. There was some baloney published back then, too, but there was also a lot of truth being written. So this is by a professor of history. I'm not going to take calls because I feel it's a little much for me. I'm kind of wobbly here. I'm not used to this. So anyway, I'm looking at Chapter 4. In The Truth About Lynching by Winfield Collins. The present criminal status of the Negro and his criminal record since the Civil War, as well, should cause every member of the race in America to hang his head in shame. Yet, may it not be that, after all, the Negro is, to a large extent, an irresponsible creature of circumstances, and that his crimes are upon the heads of those who unwisely placed him in a position that he was unable to occupy, except with injury to all concerned? Scholars hold that the average citizen of the ancient Athenian democracy, the greatest of ancient democracies, was as intelligent as the average member of the British Parliament today or of the American Congress. The Negro, however, with all his barbarism and ignorance, totally unrelated to the white man in origin, character, and race, directly after his emancipation, was made a full-fledged citizen in the greatest of modern democracies. The fact is appalling. Stupidity unsurpassed, unless by the pacifist visionaries of the present day, who seek to usher in the millennium by proclamation, peace treaties, world federations, or Leagues to Enforce Peace. That was the name of an actual organization, the League to Enforce Peace. They were the first ones, I think, to use the term New World Order. Human nature cannot be changed overnight by edict. When the sun fails to rise, wars will cease. When the sun fails to rise, then wars will cease. In other words, never. It is to be hoped that enough sanity yet remains in the American people to save them from such nonsensical vagaries of sentimental dreamers. But the Negro, son of a wild and tropical race, content for thousands of years to roam the jungles of Africa, supplied by bountiful nature with all his heart's desire, failing thus to develop any controlling trait of character or mental stamina, and although civilizations rose and fell beside him, it meant nothing to him. And even now, in the midst of American civilization, he is moved to action mainly by the gusts of primitive emotion and passion. This is the creature that was expected to take an equal share in the government of the most enlightened and progressive people that the world has ever known. People had no self-control because food was available in the tropics all year round. They didn't have to evolve mentally, not as much as white people lived in the north. Quote, who sows to the wind shall reap the whirlwind, close quote. So today, all other domestic problems or questions pale before what shall be done about the Negro. The mob acts upon it. Conventions of learned sociologists discuss it. Every superficial thinker has a solution of the problem, ready-made, but never in good working order. The Negro is such a problem in our society mainly, no doubt, because he represents the chief criminal element. How criminal, let statistics by way of comparison declare. In the northern and western states in 1910, one white person was in a penal institution for every 982 of the white population, and one Negro for every 123 of the Negro population. While in the South, the ratio was one to every 2,014 for the white, and one Negro to every 308 of the Negro population. Wow, whites and blacks were both more law-abiding in the South, apparently. Thus, in the North, Negroes had eight times their proportion in prison, and in the South, six and one-half times. That Negro crime is on the increase is evidenced by the fact that in 1890, the Negroes had hardly six times their proportion in prison in the North, and hardly five times their share in the South. So he's saying that Negro crime was on the increase already in the early 20th century. In this connection, statistical tables should be helpful and interesting as well. Table 1 gives a comparative showing of white and Negro in some state penitentiaries. Instead of giving the number of prison... Okay, let's skip the table there. Skip the table. Go to the conclusion. Tables are not very interesting to read. For the southern states considered, Table 1 shows that the number of Negro prisoners around 1910 varied according to the state, from 5-plus times their proportion in Louisiana to 11 times in Georgia. While in the north, the number varied from 8 times in Connecticut to 17, slightly less than 17 times in Kansas, thus showing that the Negro is everywhere many times more criminal than the white man, and that his criminality is more pronounced in the North than in the South. That he is discriminated against by the court and otherwise is sometimes given as a reason for the great criminal showing of the Negro. That for the same kind of crime, the Negro gets a much longer sentence than a white man, etc. This is what the liberals claim. This is hardly to be held as against the North, that it is true to any appreciable extent in the South is, let's see, so confusing sentence, that it is true to any appreciable extent in the South is doubtful, but hard to determine absolutely. As Table 1 gives the number of prisoners on hand at a certain time, and Table 2 the number committed to prison during a period of time, other things being equal, it is clear that if the Negro is discriminated against through the length of sentences imposed on him by the court, it should be shown by a smaller number being sent to prison in proportion to the respective population of the two races in any state than is to be found on hand at a certain time. For instance, at the Maryland and Texan penitentiaries, according to the above tables, in 1910, the number of Negroes on hand were respectively less than 8 times and more than 8 times their proportion, while those committed for the same year were 7, a little more than 7 and 7 respectively. Well, this is kind of tedious reading right here. See, I didn't prepare as well as I should have. As I said, I had different ideas about what I was going to do. And I got onto one idea, and then I started doing another one, and it ended up not really having anything completely done. This is why I haven't volunteered to do a show on here so far. But now, my first time on here, I have to do 2 hours? Oh, no. All right, I'm not going to read tables and comments on tables. This is ridiculous. Let me see if I can just scroll down. There are some interesting things in this book. Let's see. You should definitely get some of these old books about Negroes and have a look at them. It's amazing, amazing stuff. Yeah. Well, I tell you what. I have this thing that was written by a psychiatrist. This is William Beavis, W.M. Beavis, who was a psychiatrist at St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Washington, D.C. That was where John Hinckley was kept for many years. I think he may be getting out on passes these days. You know, the presidential assassin, John Hinckley. So it's an important mental hospital in Washington, D.C. And this is an article that Beavis wrote for the American Journal of Psychiatry, 1921, and you can find this online. He talks about mental illnesses of the Negro and what kinds of mental illnesses they get, psychological traits of the Negro in general. The Negro race evinces certain phylogenetic traits of character, habit, and behavior that seem sufficiently important to make the consideration of these peculiarities worthwhile, especially as these psychic characteristics have their effect upon and are related in the psychoses most frequently seen in the Negro. Forming so large a part of the population and living as he does under conditions, climatic and otherwise, in the South, that are favorable and natural, the Negro of the Southern states forms the basis of the observations and deductions of this brief article. Less than 300 years ago, the alien ancestors of most of the families of the Negro race in North America were savages or cannibals in the jungles of Central Africa. From this very primitive level, they were unwillingly brought to these shores and into an environment of higher civilization for which the biological development of the race had not made adequate preparation. What do they say? You can take the jungle out of the Negro, but you can't... No, wait. The other way. You can take the Negro out of the jungle. Yeah, that's the way it goes. In later years, citizenship with its novel privileges, possibly a greater transition than the first, was thrust upon the race, finding it poorly prepared intellectually for the adjustment to this new social order. Instinctively, the Negro turned to the ways of the white man, under whose tutelage he had been, and made an effort to compensate for psychic inferiority by imitation of the superior race. Thus we see in this people a talent for mimicry that is remarkable. Efforts to imitate his white neighbors in speech, dress, and social customs are often overwrought and ludicrous, but sometimes sufficiently exact to delude the uninitiated into the belief that the mental level of the Negro is only slightly inferior to that of the Caucasian. Boy, do they do that, and especially these days with the, I guess it's because of Head Start and racial integration of schools, they've got a lot of blacks talking like white people. Back in the 1970s, there wasn't that much of that. It does fool people. And that's one of the reasons why there has been such a war, I believe, on standardized testing, because standardized tests show you things that you can't tell about somebody just by talking to that person. You can't really tell how intelligent somebody is just by hearing that person talk. The person may be using words of which they don't know the meaning. I think there's a there's an episode of Boondocks where one of the Negroes in the cartoon is possessed by some kind of Negro demon. What do they call it? Stink Meaner is possessing one of these Negroes who's normally very mild-mannered. And the exorcist is Uncle Ruckus, who is an old, overweight black guy that wants to be white and claims that he was white, but he got re-vitiligo and it turned him black. But he's going to do the exorcism to get Stink Meaner out of this Negro. But one of the things that Uncle Ruckus says as he's climbing the stairs to the bedroom where he will do the exorcism, he says, Stink Meaner be using big words that he don't know the meaning of. Right? Something like that. That's exactly what this psychiatrist was just saying right here in 1921, that they know how to mimic intelligence. They can mimic the appearance of intelligence. As he says, so as to delude the uninitiated into the belief that the mental level of the Negro is only slightly inferior to that of the Caucasian. Yeah, hence the war on standardized testing. The insidious addition of white blood to the Negro race has produced significant effects upon the latter. This racial admixture of blood has been between the Negro female and the white male. Yeah, for most of the history of the United States, there was very little of the other crossing. Very few white females having black babies because of the social consequences of that. And also because white women were protected from situations where that would be likely to occur. This racial admixture of blood has been between the Negro female and the white male, with practically none between the Negro male and the white female. But we cannot agree with Hoffman, whoever that is, when he says that there is probably no true-blooded black in the United States today. A limited observation and study of the Negro families in the South will reveal the fact that there are still hundreds of the pure black African stock untouched by any possibility of miscegenation, though as the years go by, they are passing. Actually, if you go to coastal Georgia sometime, the blacks there are very black, and there are lots of them. There are lots of blacks still in the United States, especially in the South. If the original white parent were always even an average representative of his race, mentally and morally, the hereditary effect of this white admixture to the black population would naturally be that of an improvement of the traits and mentality of the blacks. But unfortunately, the white man by whom this fusion of blood starts is most often feeble-minded, criminal, or both. Quote, this miscegenation appears to have affected the longevity of the race, and the changed social environment has brought about a moral and mental deterioration, together with a diminished power of vital resistance. information has been brought out by some writers that the mulatto more nearly approaches the white in the contour and shape of the cranium, that the facial angle in the mulatto is larger than in the Negro. In other words, the jaw doesn't stick as far forward in the mulatto as in the pure Negro, less of an animal-like appearance. That the cranial capacity has been increased in the mulatto compared to the Negro, but that the race may have gained in an intellectual way, but not in a moral way, according to O'Malley. And I read another book recently that said that blacks also would say that the mixed race people seem to be more intelligent, but also less trustworthy. They were not moral people compared to pure-blooded blacks, in the opinions of some people. Healthy Negro children are bright, cunning, full of life, and intelligent. But about puberty, there begins a slowing up of mental development and a loss of interest in education, as sexual matters and a good time begin to dominate the life and have the first place in the thoughts of the Negro. From this period, promiscuous sex relations, gambling, petty thievery, drinking, loafing, and a carefree prodigal life, full to the brim with excitement, interspersed with the smallest possible amount of work, consume his time. The female of the race begins promiscuous heterosexual relations, even with grown men, at a remarkably early age, resulting in illegitimacy and the spread of venereal diseases. Now, see, this is something that conservatives like to falsify. Conservatives like to blame the amount of illegitimacy in the black community on social programs that started in the 1960s. The fact is, illegitimacy has always been rife among blacks in the United States. It's always been the case. It may have gotten worse, but it's probably been getting worse, just as crime has been getting worse, at least since the early 20th century. All right. What's really bad now is the whites have been given Negroes as a model by the Jewish mass media. Blacks are shown as a model for behavior. That's extremely destructive for us. Continuing with Beavis. Many mulattoes do not conceal their pride in being the paramour of a white man or becoming the mother of a quadroon. With their low moral level and as free agents, no wrong is felt in gratifying their natural instincts and appetites. The untoward effects of their excesses and vices are potent factors in the production of mental diseases, which is Beavis' main concern since he's a psychiatrist. Motion, music, excitement, or a combination of these make up much of the life of colored people. Their natural musical ability of a peculiar type and their sense of rhythm are too well known to make comment necessary. Motion pictures especially delight, but the modern dance has little or no charm for them. The cakewalk, shuffling, strutting, buck and wing, and such dances as give a wide range of motion to the arms, legs, and feet, suggestive of dances and orgies of the original African tribes, are executed in great style by the Negro. Naturally, the Negro lacks initiative, takes no thought. Well, I didn't put the right emphasis there. Naturally, the Negro lacks initiative, takes no thought for the immediate future, living only in the present, without recalling with any degree of concern the experiences of the past and profiting by the same. He does not worry about poverty or failure. He distrusts members of his own race and shows little or no sympathy for the other members of his race when they're in trouble. He is jolly, careless, and easily amused, but sadness and depression have little part in his psychic makeup. See, this is one of the rhetorical tricks that champions of alleged Negro intelligence will try to use. They'll try to say that that the blacks are such happy people. This is somehow an indication of intelligence. It just means that they don't worry about stuff, you know. They don't worry about things. They don't plan ahead. They don't worry. They don't stay focused. All Negroes have a fear of darkness and seldom venture out alone at night, unless on mischief bent. All Negroes are afraid of the dark, he says. Even when two or more are out together, there's always fear and much caution. This noctophobia is closely associated with the superstitions of the race and is akin to actual cowardice, so easily demonstrated and emphasized by the constant reiteration of stories of the antebellum system of patrol of the plantations, of ghosts and impressive nocturnal performances of the Ku Klux Klan. It is the conscious or unconscious wish of every Negro to be white. I'll say that again. It is the conscious or unconscious wish of every Negro to be white, says W.M. Beavis, psychiatrist, St. Elizabeth's Hospital, Washington, D.C. This is brought out in his dreams, the hope of being a white and snowy being in the eternal life, and in psychoses in which he is or was white. Negroes fantasize that they really are white. Very dear to the heart of the whole race is the privilege of belonging to a secret order. The more lodges to which the Negro belongs, the greater citizen he is considered. The secret work with its mysticism, ceremonies of initiation, parades and marches in highly colored uniforms and regalia on holidays or on funeral occasions greatly fascinate and attract both the men and the women. And actually, that tendency of the blacks, that fascination for secret societies, was incorporated in the old radio and television series Amos and Andy, because they had this quasi-Masonic order called, if I remember right, it was the Mystic Knights of the Sea. And the lodge master was the Kingfish. The Kingfish. He was the big cheese in the Negro's quasi-Masonic order. And Beavis says that blacks are really into that kind of stuff. Now, Beavis is going to talk about religion, by which he means Christianity. The religion of the Negro race in America is unique in that it is not taken as seriously as is its superstition. It is difficult to determine where one ends and the other begins. Original tribal worship, the queer racial awe of the mysterious, and associations with the white race have affected the Negro's religion. Prior to emancipation, the slaves attended the churches of the planters, occupying galleries especially prepared for them. Doctrines thus inculcated formed the background for their religious activities of later years. To these have been added such sounds, motions, and residual forms and ceremonies as have been left them by their African forefathers in efforts to appease the wrath and do honor to many deities. From time to time are added features that have proven successful in religious matters by their white friends. In their religious services, whether it be in singing, prayer, testimony, or sermon, there's always a varying accompaniment ranging from an occasional grunt, groan, or exclamation to an almost continuous volley of all of these, with continuous motion by the congregation, increasing in volume as the service progresses until a point is reached where their emotional fervor reaches its climax in wild disorder. Hallelujah! During a single service, a congregation of colored worshipers may work themselves into an hysterical state of emotional exaltation in which, quote, the real world disappears from sight and the supernatural alone exists for them, close quote. I'm not sure who he's quoting there. Behavior at these times appears to be only a step from the manic phase of manic depressive psychosis or a catatonic excitement. The service is never complete until a reaction from this state back to comparative quietude takes place. Church meetings often last 5 or 6 hours and continue every night for several weeks. Sermons and exhortation delivered and received with such emotion and enthusiasm bear little or no fruit in their everyday life and conduct, affecting favorably the morals of very few. What he's saying is religiosity, exposure to Christianity, has very little effect on Negro morality and even Negro criminality. It doesn't change their behavior to a great degree. It says it affects favorably the morals of very few. So, are white people, do we have a higher culture and civilization because we're Christian, or is it because we're white? Christianizing the blacks doesn't really help them that much, says Beavis, W.M. Beavis, the psychiatrist. Nothing in the life of the Negro stands out more prominently than his superstition. It influences his thought and conduct more than anything else. In no other trait or peculiarity do we find more plainly the imprint of primitive African life and customs. A monograph might be written describing and tracing the origin of this psychic weakness of those of ebony hue, but we mention only the most common and strongly believed superstitious ideas of the Negro, born as they are of fear, credulity, intellectual poverty, and childlike imagination. Intellectual poverty, he said. Even the most talkative of the race are reticent and ashamed to talk about their superstitions, and make great effort to conceal all traces of it in ordinary conversation. It is best understood by hearing conversations between individuals of the race when they think it is impossible to be heard by a white person. Under these circumstances, the Negroes discuss what they have heard and believe, and match experiences freely with each other. Frequently, this trait comes to the surface in delusions and obsessions, but is even then disclosed with reserve. In other words, there's a whole side to the Negro mentality that white people, according to W.M. Beavis, the psychiatrist, that white people get very little chance to see because the blacks keep it secret. They don't talk about their fear of the dark, things like that. Buried deep in the nature of this people is the belief that souls wander around, not far from the interred body during twilight, and at night, as spirits, ghosts, or hants. To trouble and disturb the peace of mind of those who have been unkind to the deceased when living. This belief and fear are sufficient to occasionally bring about optical illusions, especially if the moon is shining just a little, that are always without question taken as hants. The optical illusions are taken as hants or haunts or haints. It is also believed that the left hind foot of a rabbit found in a graveyard is a charm or fetish that will make the Negro successful at dice and in many ways ward off misfortune. Teeth of animals, snake rattles, and skins are said to possess magic powers of protection. Great faith is placed in witchcraft, palmistry, and divination. Persons who claim power to give information about the future, as in the fortune-telling of these fakers, are considered great and all-wise representatives of the Most High, especially if they present a weird appearance, use words that are difficult to pronounce and hard to understand, and do some sleight-of-hand tricks. The moon, particularly a new or waning moon, is ever to the colored man a sign of time and a reminder of death. This time of the moon is considered unfavorable for any doubtful or dangerous undertaking. It is also unlucky to start on an errand and turn back home. But if such must be done, it is necessary to make a cross mark on the ground and spit in one of the angles. Of interest to the psychiatrist is the belief in the ability of certain members of the race to conjure or place a voodoo, or spell upon another. The victim thinks that his enemy uses this power very secretly at will and for his own benefit. All sorts of bad luck, persecutions, disease, and mental conditions can be called down upon the person who is under the spell. I've actually encountered blacks online that believed in this kind of thing, more than one. This unfortunate condition can only be relieved by the intervention of some person, and I don't talk to a lot of blacks, okay? Not a lot. This unfortunate condition can only be relieved by the intervention of some person having a great power to conjure, having a greater power to conjure than the original enemy. Persons supposed to possess great power to break these spells and to ward off the evil operations or the power of the enemies are referred to as witch doctors or night doctors and are held in great reverence. Parents of a young patient having a psychosis often contend that all that is wrong is that he or she is suffering from a spell placed on him by a jealous or disappointed lover. The colored patients themselves often give being under a spell or hoodoo as an explanation for their mental difficulties. They will often say, "He controls my mind." Love powders to change one's luck in winning the affection of a person of the opposite sex, or to break the power of a rival, are much in demand, if guaranteed. With all the handicaps resulting from fears, low ideals, and primitive notions, it occasionally happens that the Negro youth is fortunate in having the proper guidance and sufficient work to prevent him from making a complete wreck of his physical and mental life. Spurred on by a good example and a wholesome desire to be an exception and a leader, who can help the race, many profit by the opportunities offered even in the South to secure a good education and to develop into most excellent citizens. All right, after this, Beavis discusses forms of mental illness that are prevalent among blacks, and he compares their occurrence among whites to the occurrence among blacks. He says that blacks suffer from schizophrenia much more than whites. This is back to Beavis here. This is not surprising when their racial character makeup and the atmosphere of superstition in which they move are considered. Much of their usual behavior seems only a step from the simpler types of schizophrenia. The catatonic form predominates, occurring almost twice as often as among white patients. And then he notes that alcoholism and suicide are relatively rare among Negroes. It says only Jews have less alcoholism than Negroes. If we consider the psychoses of the Negro from the mechanistic viewpoint, it will be found that practically all may be correctly included in the following classes, named in the order most frequently observed: dissociation, compensatory, and repression. Most of such psychoses are benign and acute, but may become chronic. In other words, they get a little crazy. They get crazy for a little while, and then it goes away. But may become chronic if improvement does not relieve the situation in time to prevent it. The most common causative factors in the dissociation types are inability to prevent repressed, disguised cravings from breaking through the ego's resistance, as mentioned by Kempf. Toxic elements and real or imaginary domination by others. Conflicts or situations becoming almost unbearable, with no suitable means of sublimating or otherwise avoiding, making a psychosis of this character an easy avenue of escape from the field of reality. An example is the case of a woman who was under the influence of a spell put upon her by another. She committed a crime, asserting that it was not she that did it, but that under this uncontrollable influence, she became the other person's helpless agent. Fear is the all-pervading cause in the compensatory class of mental illness among the Negroes. Fear of fear, fear of sexual impotency, and fear of loss of the love object being the most noticeable elements. These manifest themselves in grandiose, unreasonable claims, persecutory ideas, and pathological lying. An example is the case of a man who, although black, said that he was the commissioned representative of God to protect white women, and that he might be more effectual in his mission if he were made white. And for all these reasons, he has been grossly mistreated by both black and white. Oh, wait a second. I misread that. He said that he was the commissioned representative of God to protect white women and that he might be more effectual in his... So that he might be more effectual in his mission, he was made white. Oh, he was created, magically turned white. It's just that he was the only one that could see it. Sometimes the way they word these things in the old... text is a little confusing. All right. So this Negro imagines that he's been turned into a white person and he's being persecuted for it, even though God has appointed him to be the protector of white women. The repression type makes up the smallest part of the racial psychoses under consideration and is more of a compulsion neurosis than a psychosis. See, there's only a little bit of gobbledygook here. I know a lot of you people don't know what those words mean, but, you know, it's like a sentence here and there has those words. There are phobias and obsessions suggestive of psychasthenia, which means weak-mindedness. That's what it means, psychasthenia, weak-mindedness. As so clearly expressed by White, there seems to be an alteration between love and hate with no possibility of the formation of a working compromise. This type is more often seen in those who show an appreciable portion of white ancestry. Okay, now we get to Beavis's summary. In our observation, the following points are made. 1. The Southern Negro has certain psychological traits that are reflected in his psychoses. 2. Motion, rhythm, music, and excitement make up a large part of the life of the race. 3. Naturally, the most of the race are carefree, live in the here and now, with limited capacity to recall or profit by experiences of the past. Sadness and depression have little part in his psychological makeup. 4. Of all his peculiarities, fears, and superstitious ideas stand out most prominently. Of all his peculiarities, fears and superstitious ideas stand out most prominently. 5, the number of cases of alcoholic psychoses is surprisingly low among the Negro. 6, suicide and suicidal tendencies are almost absent in colored patients, the ratio being about 1 to 3,000 in state hospitals. I think that's probably gone up today since there are a lot more mixed-race people. 7, the incidence of cerebrospinal syphilis and paresis is relatively low in the southern Negro. 8, manic depressive psychoses are observed to occur in higher percentage than that given by Green in 1916, 17%. The manic phase is the one nearly always found. Schizophrenia stands at the head of the list of the psychoses of the colored. Catatonic form occurring about twice as often as in the white, and paranoid form occurring next in importance. 10, mechanistic classification of the psychoses of this race show that nearly all are dissociation, compensatory, or repression types. So you see there are a lot of differences between whites and Negroes, other than just IQ. A lot more. They have a whole different set of mental illnesses. And I've got to pull up something else now to read. Actually, if you look at Nation of Islam stuff sometimes, that's almost enough right there to convince you that there be bunches of crazy Negroes out there. Okay, because they have a whole mythology that they've cooked up. They have this mythology where people live underneath the ground in the center of the earth, and some of them have these big bulbous heads, and they're black, and others have cone heads. They look exactly like the cone heads from the old Saturday Night Live skit. I think they must have gotten the idea from the Nation of Islam. And because that's, you can actually find this on YouTube, a video that represents this Nation of Islam mythology. And the way it begins with a double helix, image of a double helix, you get the idea that this looks like a very professionally produced video. And the whole thing is very slickly done, but the content is totally wacko. These blacks have been trained to do video production. Some black has been trained to do video production, and he used it to do crazy stuff. Crazy stuff. So, yeah, the legend that they have is that, I don't remember the whole thing, but there were black people living in peace on the surface of the earth, but there were also these other blacks that had giant bulbous crania and giant brains. And they lived in the center of the earth, along with the coneheads. And at some point, the coneheads and the bulbous-headed black people in the middle of the earth intermarried. And, or at least a king of one group and the king of the other group, queen, well, royal families of the two groups intermarried. And they produced an offspring that was called the Big Head Scientist, because he was a freak, being crossed between a cone head and a bulb head. He had two brains inside his skull. This was the evil scientist, Dr. Yacoub. He was called a big brain scientist. Actually, he had two brains, but they call him Dr. Yacoub, the big brain, the evil big brain scientist. And Dr. Yacoub is given responsibility for creating the white race, the evil Dr. Yacoub. He was angry. He had some kind of grudge against the world. So he created white people who, according to Nation of Islam mythology, were bred through selective breeding. Dr. Yacoub created a race of leprous albinoids. Grafting comes into it somehow. I'm not sure exactly how that works. But the evil Dr. Yacoub, the big brain scientist, created the grafted white devils. So that's Nation of Islam mythology. Got 10 minutes left here. This is another piece about Negroes that I found, which is pretty interesting. Anti-white media bias in 1899. Walter F. Wilcox, 1861 to 1964. He was a professor in the Department of Political Science and History at Cornell University. He authored the entry titled Negro in the very highly regarded 11th edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica, the 11th edition. As in many other matters, the first task in getting a correct picture of the Negro is to overcome misinformation. And Professor Wilcox recognized that there was a tendency toward distorted reporting by the newspapers of his own state of Massachusetts regarding racial conflicts in the South. Biased newspaper reporting, even in 1899. Anti-white bias. I found this interesting passage in a speech that Professor Wilcox gave called Negro Criminality, which he delivered before the American Social Sciences Association at Saratoga, New York, on 6th of September, 1899. Professor Wilcox, I cannot accept a large proportion of the accounts printed in Northern papers describing the relations of the two races in the South. One of the virtues of civilization imperfectly developed in the Negro race is veracity, truthfulness, in other words, and accounts coming from them must be tested carefully before acceptance. Where nothing is known regarding the trustworthiness of the witnesses or the inherent probability of the statements, the presumption is in favor of the white man's testimony. He means the presumption should be in favor of the white man's testimony. Hence, those newspapers which apparently make the contrary presumption are often misled. One instance which came under my own observation may serve for 100. Recently, a lynching occurred in Alexandria, Virginia, within 5 miles of the national capital. A Washington correspondent of the Boston Transcript described the facts and said that the Negro boy was guilty of nothing more than insulting a child. The Springfield Republican reprinted the letter and in editorial comment said that the boy's only crime was his color. I went at once to the mayor of Alexandria, Virginia, and learned from him that at a hearing over which he presided, the 8-year-old girl testified that the Negro had been guilty of indecent familiarities upon her by force. Probably any Southern jury, on hearing the child's testimony, would have found the Negro guilty of an attempt to commit rape. Yet representative Northern newspapers, in reliance upon their sources of information, have seriously misrepresented the facts. And that's on page 23 of Wilcox's speech, Negro Criminality. While Professor Wilcox observes the Negro's lack of veracity, lack of truthfulness, and the excessive credulity of Northerners who are unaware of this lack of veracity, he makes no observation about the fact that those who give this excessive credence derive gratification from it. The opportunity for assuming a posture of moral superiority to the bad old Southern racist is a temptation that people of a particular Southern, particular mindset seem unable to resist, even if they must distort the facts to make it possible. It is not only a problem of the excessive belief in Negro lies, but of bias on the part of those not only believing the lies, but capitalizing on them. The example of bias that Professor Wilcox cites is very far from unique. When Professor Wilcox said that this one example might serve for 100, he meant that this kind of thing happened all the time. An entire false history of gratuitous cruelty toward the Negro can be and has been constructed on the basis of such inflammatory false reporting. It still happens all the time today. Most blatantly, in recent memory, because it received so much publicity, the recent matter of George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin. And I tell you, there are still people, believe it or not, trying to argue that George Zimmerman killed Trayvon Martin, not because Trayvon Martin attacked him, pinned him to the ground, was punching him in the face, beating his head against the sidewalk. No. It was because George Zimmerman was a bad old racist who hunted poor old Trayvon Martin down just to be a mean old racist. What's wrong with these people? I mean, I'm hearing even people that are not black saying this stuff. I suppose that some of them are Jews, because we know that Jews dominate mass media in the United States today. And we know that Jews were behind the so-called civil rights movement in the 1960s. But I think there are also some white moral grandstanders that are getting on this bandwagon of making ridiculous assertions. You know, without the white traitors, Jews really couldn't do very much to us. That's one respect in which Jared Taylor is actually correct. He's actually correct. White traitors and lack of loyalty among white people is our greatest fundamental problem. This was something that Adolf Hitler in particular wanted to address. And he says that the traitors in the German nation bothered him much more than his former enemies from the First World War. With the enemies, he could make a reconciliation, but not with traitors. All right. Well, I've had fun here. I hope this didn't bore you to death. And maybe see you in a few days on the International Jew Hour. Mike's free. Ha!
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.